Episode 3, Collected Materials, Mythology, and Archiving for Climate Change. For today's installment of the Echoic Archive, Waylon sits down with Filipino artist Leroy New, who has been commissioned to create the Earth Day 2022 sculpture in Somerset House's courtyard. The two discuss creating with collected materials, indigenous mythology, and archiving in the face of the climate emergency. Welcome to the Echoic Archive.
My name is Leroy New. I am a practicing artist and designer, but I mostly do large-scale, immersive, spatial constructions. I am informed a lot by the sci-fi and fantasy creative sources that I took in as a child due to the absence of art sources, you know, in this small town in the south of the Philippines. But I say that now, I didn't realize there was an absence of art back then. But when I sometimes go with my mom works as a nanny in New York, and she would take the kids that she takes care of in Cooper Hewitt Museum or the Metropolitan Art Museum. And I just, you know, saw how vast the difference was. I had like maybe a few paintings that I saw in our local malls, you know, like the more traditional images, probably imitations of Western traditional painting, but in the with representing local subject matter, for example, like rice paddies or farmers with water buffaloes and coconut trees and the sunset. So there were very limited art pieces in my town. I mean, to me, they were art, and they were the art that I wanted to do growing up. But yes, there was an absence, so I had to be creative in seeking out my sources for art and anything creative. And these came in the form of graphic novels, horror films, sci-fi films, fantasy films, illustrated card games that I saw some older kids were playing. I saw like TV shows that exposed movie magic, you know, special effect shows. That was also quite foundational in my idea of how I can apply my creative sensibility onto many different things. Because these were like people making scale model sets, making crazy costumes and prosthetics, building life-size sets too. So, you know, the idea of creative practice in relation to building worlds, this was kind of what I subconsciously kind of internalized and eventually externalized with my practice.
You talk a lot about the influences that impact you in your practice. From what I've seen, there's definitely a big influence from your indigenous culture. And you've mentioned to me previously that a lot of that comes from your grandmother. Mm-hmm. Could you describe your earliest memory of your grandmother?
Yes. My grandmother was a strong lady. In my memory as a child, she was a tall figure that smelled of tobacco. She would roll her own tobacco. And I even painted a portrait of her at one point with her face covered in smoke. Because those were like very distinct memories of her. And it also helped that she was the source of these like local, like these folk stories, I guess, that she would tell to us as kids. She would tell us of how she trained aswangs or sigbins. Aswang is kind of like our default term for supernatural creatures. And the sigbin is kind of like described as a dog kangaroo creature hybrid. I mean, we didn't know what kangaroos were, but it And looking back, it's described as if it was hunched on its back with like hind legs, prominent hind legs. And she would tell us how she managed to tame some of these creatures and they would do her bidding. So, you know, she was a powerful figure. She was the source of good food and stories. And, you know, you don't realize it back then, but these stories kind of stick with you and kind of establish your preference for certain things. The piece that I'm doing for the Courtyard of Somerset is called The Arcs of Gimokudan, or Mga Arko ng Gimokudan. Gimokudan is a word I borrowed from Bagobo mythology, located in the south of the Philippines. Gimokudan is their word for the afterlife or the underworld. I knew as an art student that I was looking for these alternative stories. At that time, I had to introduce myself to these pre-colonial mythologies and all these other stories that we didn't grow up with. You know, there was like a resistance to the Catholic mythology that we practiced. We were kind of expected to practice as kids in that kind of very conservative city that I grew up in. I kind of developed a taste for the supernatural, the mystical, the mythological. To me, these were all the same stories, the same yearnings of man to, you know, give form to the unknowable or to try to give form to our aspirations for the future. With my work now, I've kind of fast-tracked my practice to challenge myself to strictly use collected materials as much as I can. Whereas before I would do large-scale works, I would use collected objects, but also I would use a lot of like new materials as well. My source for these would be the local market districts in the Philippines. You know, I would explore anything and everything that I could find in there. They basically sold everything you can find, like, you know, anything from illegal animals to wedding souvenirs in those places. And as I was resisting the more traditional forms of art making, like painting and traditional sculpture, I found myself in these places where I thought it was humorous to me to be able to use the same objects that people use in their daily lives and to be able to transform them. So the work itself aims to address the use of new materials and tries not to add to waste production as much as possible, but also showcasing how, you know, these very basic objects can be transformed into something, well, in my words, alien or unfamiliar or fantastical.
The conversation with Leroy about indigenous mythology, collected materials and art made me think about one of my own practices. A practice that begins with a Yoruba god called Ogun. Ogun is one of the oldest Orisha or deities in the Yoruba pantheon. Ogun is known as the god of metalwork and of war. It is believed that he is the first Orisha to have come to Earth and is heralded among the others for showing them the pathway. Worship of Ogun goes back to the Iron Age or around 400 BC and it continues to this day, with some scholars suggesting that Ogun is worshipped by over 70 million people across the world in countries like Haiti, Brazil, as well as Trinidad and Tobago. They often celebrated him with elaborate musical rituals that involved a lot of drumming. It is by no surprise then that rituals that praised Orishas like Ogun were forced underground as part of the overall colonial policy of repressing the African culture of those domiciled on former slave plantation islands. The British colonial government banned drumming in Trinidad in 1877. This is also around the time that oil started being produced in Trinidad by international corporations. I'm going to finish the story of Ogun a little later in the episode, but I wanted to return to my conversation with Leroy, where, building off the idea of collective materials, we started discussing plastic pollution in the Philippines.
Well, before you collect them, and they are collected, these kind of materials, these plastic bottles, are they left kind of just around generally in Manila?
This has to do with a lot of things. You know, we have very poor infrastructure when it comes to waste collection and segregation. Waste segregation from the home is not effectively enforced. There are no incentives for people to enforce it. Also, we're a very big population and we're the target for these large companies who want to sell more. And so you have the sachet phenomenon where, you know, people can't buy big bottles of shampoo. So instead, they would repack shampoo into like small plastic sachets, the size of, you know, ketchup sachets in fast food brands. So you end up with, you know, people being able to buy more, buy little, but also resulting in a lot of extra packaging, excess packaging. We don't have the most efficient recycling centers. So a lot of it does, you know, end up in landfills and in the oceans or wherever. There's insufficient education about the issues as well. That happens when a large number of the population is just, you know, trying to survive. They have no room to think about ideas of recycling and sustainability. So there's it has to do with like major infrastructure problems, so that means there's a lot of plastic to go around. And in my mind, if I can apply my skills as a designer and artist in any material that I choose to use, why not, you know, focus it on a certain material that needs addressing.
When was the first time that you started working with collected materials?
I guess it had to do when I got accepted into art school, art high school specifically. When I was 12, I applied for this art high school in the Philippines called Philippine High School for the Arts, which was run by the government. So if you got in, if you passed the talent test, then your education for 4 years in high school is free. I didn't want to apply for any other high school when I heard about this school. So I took the entrance, the auditions, or, you know, the talent test. I was lucky enough to be accepted. And it was a major culture shock. Coming from this, you know, small conservative, small city in the south of the Philippines, known mainly for fishing. And I had to fly 2 hours to Manila, you know, kind of the capital, the center. I realized I was like a small town boy when I stepped foot on that school. The school was located on the periphery of a mountain, so it was like, you know, we felt like we were like little X-Men, you know. it was like a resort. It looked like a resort. Just the fact that I saw boys with long hair was a shock to me. So, you know, I was shocked, you know, to think like, oh. And so that all hell broke loose after that, you know. my mentors there did all sorts of stuff. Like there was one who transformed sweaters into vaginas or giant kinetic sculptures. And this other mentor did very intricate sculptures made out of sawdust. You know, just collected sawdust and transformed them. And that kind of blew my mind and broke my preconceptions of what art was, or reinforced certain things I've seen when I was a kid. That, you know, there, an art practice or a creative practice is not limited to like one or two forms, you know. And yeah, so I tried everything then, and until now, I'm still constantly rethinking and reshaping and experimenting with how I work.
In defiance of the British laws that ban drumming, Trinidadians would use lengths of bamboo as percussions in place of drums in what became known as tambu bamboo. On the surface, the practice of tambu bamboo appeared to be an innocuous art form, but in reality, it created space where African history, traditions, spirituality, and rituals were being passed down with the assistance of music. By the 1930s, crude oil production in Trinidad increased to 10 million barrels per year, earning large amounts of money for the big corporations, but very little for the oil-filled workers, as described by Buzz Butler.
Conditions of the poor Indians and Negroes in sugar and oil, respectively, was nothing short of subhuman.
Resistance to the harsh and exploitative working conditions and general repression by the British began to grow. Some said the spirit of Ogun began to take hold on the people of Trinidad.
When did you first become aware of the climate crisis and how it is impacting or will go on to impact the Philippines?
You know, I think I came from a generation where we were exposed to certain films or shows that made it easy for us to understand the situation now. You know, there was like, I remember seeing Fern Gully as a kid. I don't know if you've seen Fern Gully. The more obvious shows, I guess, are like Captain Planet or whatever. Yeah, we were exposed to those kinds of stories as kids. It wasn't hard for us to be open to these, the idea that humanity is doing incredible damage to the earth that we're living in, to the world that we're living in. I mean, we see it every day in the Philippines. You see like these rivers filled with trash and they're like, they look like, it looks like you're gonna get really sick if you end up falling in one of those rivers. Yeah, you see like people living on a dump site, you know, like collecting trash, burning tires, or like cleaning plastic. You see firsthand how the land itself is being transformed into this place, the sick looking place.
And how has you learning about the climate crisis, how has that impacted your practice?
I tend to police myself more than my peers with how I do things. You know, I'm always striving to be better. That's why I end up doing all sorts of very different things, because I'm always constantly trying to seek out a better way than the previous works that I've done. You know, there's the idea of settling into one kind of thesis or one kind of a style or look is not something that I aspire for. I do aspire for ideas that help, that bring about some positive change. And you know, there's this anxiety with artists that what we do is eventually, you know, useless. And how can art practice coincide with other ideas ideas that are, that contribute, that offer some viable solution, you know? And I think that's a challenge these days for creatives.
Pieces of scrap iron, metal containers and graters left discarded from oil production became the foundation of musical instruments that would be used to rally the people of Trinidad in protest against not only the colonial rule, but the exploitation and ecological damage caused by oil production. These metal instruments began to dominate tambu bambu. Over time, tambu bambu players learned to control the shaping of these metal containers in order to tune specific notes on them, leading to the invention of the only acoustic instrument created in the 20th century, the steel pan.
Could you tell me your name and what you do?
My name is Kyron Akal. It's a name that was designed by Trinidadians, so it has to be said with a Trinidadian accent no matter where you come from. Kyron Akal. I am a steel pan performer, soloist, and teacher, tutor.
Composer.
Composer, yeah. Them kind of words. Yes, those big words there.
When was the first time you ever saw a pan or heard pan?
I think, that might be, because I'm going to start sharing my age here, it might have been when Desperados came over in 1979. So Desperados is a steel band from Trinidad, one of the big five, as you call it, one of the most reputable and best bands in the world. And they came over to England in 1979, and I think they took part in the Notting Hill Carnival. And I believe that year I was playing a bumblebee for a band called Starlift, as in Mars. So Mars is, Notting Hill Carnival costumes and all the rest of it. And I was a little bumblebee. So then I played Mars with Kokie after that for a few years. And in those days, Kokie was the Mars band and Metronomes was the steel band, and they were both linked together. When I started playing Mars with Kokie, my sister was involved in the steel band. My whole family was really, well, not my whole family, my parents, myself and my sister were involved in Mars and Pan. My sister was playing Pan, I was playing Mars, and I think that was when I kind of was around Pan and I was hooked from the start. I wasn't allowed to play at first, but eventually I took off the costume and picked up the sticks.
Today you're going to be playing a song called The Journey for us. Could you tell me a bit about the song, when you composed it, and yeah, what's the story behind The Journey?
As a person of West Indian parentage, both my parents being born Trinidadians, very thick Trinidadian accents, and grew up eating very Trinidadian food to the point where I used to turn up my nose at the school, the food at primary school. You know what I mean? Being around carnival and pan from such a young age, being kind of endorsed in it, marinated in it, and then having to deal with the British society and kind of trying to figure out what you are. I remember being in primary school and arguing with other friends of mine who were also black, who were Senior parents, that I didn't, or I almost used the word identify. We didn't speak like that back then. I don't identify as. But I didn't feel English. Like, I didn't, when it's about me being, I think it was around the World Cup or something, and it was about supporting England. And I was like, well, okay. At that time, that's how I felt. Do you get me? Like, and then my same mates, who I guess I thought would have felt the same way as I did, were like, I'm proud of England. I am proud, but at that point in time, I didn't really relate to being English at all. I also then after that went and lived in Trinidad for a little while. I went to school in Trinidad for a while, and that didn't help, I guess, with the fact that I had strongly identified then as a Trinidadian. And I think The Journey was about that journey as a British, black, West Indian person, figuring out exactly how Trini I am, exactly how British I am, how Tringlish, I guess. Do you know what I mean? And it's a bit different now. It's really funny because this whole country is very, very different. How we all are as West Indians here is very, very different compared to how I grew up back in the day around Ladbroke Grove and Highbury and Dalston and all these places that I grew up in and whatnot, and being around the carnival and being in such a thick, rich community, you understand, which scarcely exists now, if we're going to be honest, you know? But I grew up in that. I was marinated in that, you see it? And in Trinidad as well, about, you know, the band I was in Trinidad is a band called Trinidad All Stars, again, one of the best bands in the world, without a doubt. And, you know, playing Pan in that band, being around my friends in the band at that point in time, coming back to England, getting back to school, the culture shock of it all. Yeah, it's just what it's about, figuring that stuff out. And I think a lot of us can relate to that in many different ways. It might mean something completely different to the listener, but that's what it is for me.
What is the role of the artist in preserving traditional cultures from our small island developing states in the face of this climate crisis?
I mean, that is a question that we are constantly grappling with, and not just even with the climate crisis. You know, we feel that we've undergone colonization, and, being a neo-colony and globalization. So, you know, our ideas about cultural identity is, in a way, fragile to begin with because we're fairly multicultural in the Philippines before we were arbitrarily decided to be a country according to the Spanish, you know, by naming us after their king. All of a sudden, and all of these multilingual islands, this archipelago is one country now. So we have very hybrid ideas about how cultural identity can move into the future. I'm part of the persuasion that you bring your cultural identity with you no matter what. And you know, even if you decide that you want to do sci-fi imagery, my training in the arts of being in touch with my personal histories has allowed me to bring these traditions with me, even in not so obvious ways. But yeah, in the creative industry, it's really just being able to like express these things constantly, even under changing technologies and under changing circumstances. Even if I'm faced with like my work for Somerset, for example, for the courtyard, even if I go through the material wastes in London, I will end up transforming these very specific wastes that are made specifically for one country into something that will carry my story. So that is how I intend to make use of my specific training and my specific pool of information to perpetuate the stories that I grew up with and the future stories that I want for myself and my community.
This episode is produced, sound designed, and narrated by Waylon Mackenzie Witter, with introductions from me, Laurent John, and additional music by Kyra Nicole. The Somerset House podcast is executive produced by Eleanor Scott.